There we go. So, I think I've admitted this before. I'm being the one up here preaching. You should probably not admit this, but it was not that many years ago when I pretty much just discounted the Old Testament and said, yeah, that's just too much work for me. I had grown up in the faith, and I wouldn't say it was really quite my own. I have a wonderful father and mother that taught me the right ways, but sort of grew away a little bit, came back as I got a little older and said, hey, I got to figure this out for myself. And at that point, I was just sort of like, look, I am not digging into the Old Testament because that just racks my brain.
But you don't start out in Genesis.
Well, I'm getting there. That was where I was for many years. So if you are there right now, that is perfectly understandable. I was there with you. So now, yes, Harry's summary of all my sermons at school is Genesis, Jesus. And we sort of end up there, right? So today we'll start in Genesis, believe it or not. But what we are going to study is Daniel. So if you are at that place where you're just sort of like, Old Testament, that's fine. Genesis is wonderful, and I strongly recommend it. But as you get into it, Daniel is a really cool book that's sort of a crossroads of a lot of things, of prophecy and just of biblical history and stories, of regular history gets weaved into it a lot. So it's a cool place to sort of dig in and start on. So hopefully, the other thing about it is it's a very large story about Babylon. And Babylon is sort of the archetype of what goes wrong when men get together and exalt themselves. So it's a pretty interesting contrast and study on where we are in the world. So I find it sort of useful just to have that big picture framing anyways as we get there. So we will spend all of today in Daniel, but I'm going to start in Genesis. So just for a minute or two, because it helps sets the stage, right? So, and it's not just any part of Genesis. It's always somewhere between 1 and 12 where I start every message. So in Genesis 1:26, you don't even have to go there if you don't want to, because people will know the scripture, and it's the scripture that talks about us being made in God's image, right? So then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. They will rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, the livestock, the whole earth, and the creatures that crawl on the earth. And then a little bit after that, it says, God blessed them, and God sent to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it. Rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and every creature that crawls on the earth. Right. So, one, just an interesting side note, if you didn't know, the word it says in his image, that word is the word that's used for idol all through the Old Testament. So, when God says, do not make any idols before me, don't make any likenesses before me, in a way, what he's saying is, I've already done that. I've made humanity in my image. You know what I mean? You have value and importance because you're made in the literal image of the Creator God. Right? So you don't need to put something else out there and worship something that you create, because I've already made you. And you're valuable and you're important, right? So only takes until like a few pages later, there's a personal rebellion because we want to be like God. Right? So Adam and Eve rebel and they say, we want to be like God, and they eat of the fruit. Right? So that sort of first taste of sin is literally a beast coming in, right? It's the snake coming in and saying, hey, by the way, did God really say that you shouldn't eat that, right? And then you go on to your next account, which is Cain and Abel, right? And there's no beast there, and they're not really quite directly talking with God, but it takes a step back and it says, hey, by the way, God talks to him and says, sin is prowling like a lion there to get you. Right? And you sort of step back and you keep going through Genesis up to 11. And basically, it's this sort of starts with the personal account and then it moves up to the corporate. What happens when men get together? You know what I mean? So you have your personal sin, but then you also, when we get together as groups, corporately, we sin. We rebel against God. We try to raise ourselves up, right? So if you get to chapter 11, as it sort of goes through this whole thing, you get to a place that was created by a man with a wonderful name, Nimrod, which is where the name comes from, because he started Babylon. What a wonderful place to have your name on, right? So if you did not know that, the Tower of Babel is actually the Tower of Babylon. It was shortened in I think it might have been King James or a version just before that, but the name is actually the Tower of Babylon, and it was shortened to Babel. And it sort of fits the story to say you're babbling or whatever, but I think you sort of miss out on the fact that, hey, by the way, this is Babylon. The archetype of all that goes wrong when we get together is the very first city. We all get together. We build up. They want to build this tower, and they say, let's build a name for ourselves by building a tower up to the sky, right? So you can tell just in that wording that, hey, by the way, they're rebelling against God's authority, right? They're throwing that off. It's even a little bit more than that, because as you start out, if you notice when you start reading Genesis, when you name something, you take authority over it. So if you go through the creation account, God says, I'm creating day and night, and I'm naming day and night, right? Because this is mine. I have authority over it. And he goes through the whole thing, and he creates the earth, sets everything up, he creates man, and he says, all right, man, Adam, which is a word for man, you go off and name the beasts of the field and all these other things. You give them names because I've given you authority over the beasts of the field and everything else. You're to rule those beasts on my behalf, so you get to name them, right? So then they all get together and build the tower and say, hey, let's build a name for ourselves, right? We're going to cast off that naming, that authority that God has over us. We're going to exalt ourselves. And believe it or not, it doesn't go well, right? So their language is confused, and you end up with what they call the Table of Nations, which is all the different nations of that time that were created with all different languages and everything else, right? So it sort of sets everything up perfectly, and then the very next page, you flip to Genesis 12, is God choosing his people, right? It's Abram, and God saying, all right, this plan is not working. When people get together, they mess it up. I'm going to choose a people, and it starts this whole plan forward, right? And believe it or not, where does Abram leave when he's called? He's in Babylon, right? And he says, leave Babylon, leave your friends, leave your family, leave all of those people. Go to this holy land that I'm sending you to, all right? So, it's not coincidental that you go all the way through the Old Testament. You have a wonderful, finally, nation building. You get David, he builds Israel, and he's sort of the peak of their civilization, and things are going pretty good. He hands it off to his son Solomon, and it's funny because it never quite says that Solomon is a bad king, but if you read sort of through it, he's got an awful lot of excesses in his wives and his money and his everything, and you can see it sort of start to slip. And if you read through the whole Old Testament, the nations split. There's two countries, two nations. The first one in the north falls, and then Judah is the last to sort of hold on in Jerusalem. And guess what nation rises up to end the Israelite nation? It is Babylon, believe it or not. It comes back, right? So there are some themes through David because, Daniel, because that, I don't know if I can put this here. Sorry. The fan keeps flipping on my pages. There are some themes that go all the way through Daniel. One of them is, where do you place your hope? Right? Daniel is all about who's in control in these situations. You got to imagine, and we'll get into it, but basically Daniel has just been taken out of Israel as a slave and brought to Babylon, and he's living there. And he's sort of looking at things like, whew, this is not going well, right? This is not all we had hoped as a nation. It isn't going the way we sort of hope it will be, right? So, but he knows these promises of God that says, you know, I will be your God and you will be my people. Right? You respect my authority. You become my people And I will be your God and I'll redeem you, right? He knows those promises are there, but it's just not working out at the time he's going into this book, is it, right? So the question is then, where do you place your hope? So Daniel's in that place for 60, 65 years. Near the end of it, he has a vision where he says, I'm hoping maybe I'll get the chance to see Israel redeemed. You know, we were supposed to be out for 70 years. Is that the way it's going to go, God? And God says, well, make that 70 times 7, which is closer to 500 years. So you are not making it to any sort of Holy Land, son. And Daniel is still faithful and still has his hope in God, right? So that's a real cool theme that goes all the way through it and very strong. And it's tied in with this whole faithfulness in exile theme. Right? There's a lot of exile themes. It starts again, page one of the Genesis. They get tossed out of the garden. They are exiles. You're going to have to work the ground. You're going to have to do that, right? And then you've got all the way in Egypt, and they're exiles, and they're in the Holy Land, and now they're thrown out again, and they're in Babylon. And then as you get into the New Testament, all the language continues that theme that, you know, we're strangers here. We're not meant to live in this world. We are still exiles every day. And how do we live as faithful Christian servants when you're in this exile, right? So it's another reason why Daniel is a very cool book, because that's the situation he's in, right? He's a physical, for sure, exile in a foreign country, but it's the same sort of theme that goes on. And the last one is just Babylon itself, right? Instead of respecting God's authority and ruling on his behalf over the beasts of the field, creating order and living according to his ways, men tend to exalt themselves and behave like beasts. That's the way Daniel sort of pretends it. But it's that same language, that flesh nature that you have, that you need to control, right? And we're going to talk about that as we go through it. So, all of this is a very cool book, right? All of those things all knit together. And if you're not into the Old Testament, it's a neat one as well, especially up to sort of chapter 7, is a really fun read, right? It reads relatively quick and good stories and good things to sort of get your hands on. So if you're not into it, we're going to go through it kind of quick, but it's sort of a good precursor to say, hey, go off and read this. It's a good time to do a study on that, right? So, but I like it because this is where God and Babylon sort of come face to face, right? This is where they meet in the Old Testament, and you get to sort of see behind the scenes of how God interacts with these rulers and nations, right? So, right at the beginning, line one, it basically says, God used Babylon to judge Israel, right? So you know these sort of things happen, but you're like, you're not God, you're not in those, you know, throne rooms and knowing how this all works. And Daniel is the closest you get to sort of him pulling back the curtain and saying, hey, by the way, this is my interaction with these kings, with these nations. This is what's going on a personal level that will have impacts on a national level of all these things happening, right? So the format for all of Daniel is you've got this sort of little intro chapter in Hebrew. It's only like a page, not even. And then there's actually 6 chapters of Daniel that are in Aramaic. They're actually not in Hebrew. And they're sort of set apart in this nice little section. And then it finishes with a whole bunch of visions that Daniel has that he sort of tells you about, right? But it follows a very familiar Old Testament format that a ton of the Psalms and even sections of Genesis, they all work this way, that the Hebrews, they start here and they build up to a point, and then they work back to it. So if you ever, you must have noticed it if you read Psalms often, that they'll start with something, they'll tell you it leads up to this, and then they sort of repeat themselves, and they work their way back to where they started, right? It's just a normal thing that happens, right? So this whole section of Aramaic, in the middle of that, each one is a separate chapter. So in chapters 4 and 5, where they come together, there's 2 bookend stories right next to each other of God personally dealing with these rulers of kingdoms, right? He's actually going back and forth with Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, right? And they're back-to-back stories of him basically saying, you guys are not recognizing my authority, what's going on here? And there's 2 stories. One of them relents and says, fair enough, you're God. I'll take that authority, and he's restored, and the other one is too far gone, and he gets judged, right? So those stories are in the middle, and they're sort of pretty cool for the most part, right? So it sort of tells you right there in the beef of this, in the meat of it, that this is a message of hope in a funny sort of way for Daniel, because it shows him that God still is in control, right? You have this nation of Babylon that literally rules the whole world, right? This guy wakes up in a bad mood, and he does in this. We won't do that one today, but we'll do it next week. He wakes up in a bad mood, and he's going to kill several hundred, maybe even 1,000 people, because he had a bad dream, right? He's like, I had a bad dream. People's heads are going to roll. And you're sort of like, whoa, this is kind of crazy. You know what I mean? We don't even comprehend living in a world like that, where a guy can just have a bad dream and just wake up and, I'm going to kill thousands of people today. It's crazy, right? But what happens through the center of this book is that you learn God is still in control, right? Certain things happen, and we have to discuss that and pull it all together. But Daniel understands, he's faithful, and he realizes that if you are willing to submit to God's authority and be his people, then he will be your God, right? So it is a message of hope, which is kind of neat. So just outside of those, there are two stories. Those would be chapter 3 and 6. So that's sort of the main thrust of this whole thing. And then outside of that, there's two stories that are almost the same story in different situations, and they're both hopefully ones you're familiar with, even if you don't like the Old Testament. You've got Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego getting thrown in the fiery furnace, and you have Daniel being thrown in the lion's den, right? So we will next week follow some of those parallels and whatever, but you can see this is faithful servants living in Babylon, and how are you faithful? How do you live there? And if you've ever read the stories, they do. They're citizens. They support the nation in some ways, but there's also clearly lines that they draw. And what happens when you draw those lines? So in those cases, God protects them and serves them, right? So, but how do we behave? How will God protect us? What is going to happen? And then in chapters 2 and 7, the furthest ones out from that, there's two visions. One is Nebuchadnezzar's, one's Daniel's, but it's all the nations as they stack up. And it sort of goes through those. So we'll get through that at the end. But basically, they're very, very similar visions. The stories of Shadrach and Daniel are very similar in their structure and setup. And then the two visions of the kings, right? So you sort of step your way up to that, and then you work your way back, right? So all the way through that, you see this sort of weaving of personal sin and corporate sin as countries, and how those things interact. How are we faithful servants of God through all of that? And how do you sort of work through those and understand that God is righteous all the way throughout that, right? So I was just listening to a sermon. It was on the visions at the end, but the guy was talking about God's righteousness, and it was like this, I don't want to say epiphany, because the guy just said it and I just sort of understood it and I didn't understand, but it was a very foundational learning for me, and I liked it, right? In the end of this, Daniel is actually appealing to God about that 70 times 70 that I told you. He's sort of saying, hey, is this almost done? Are we almost finished? Are we at 70 years, right? And he's appealing to God, and he's saying, look, we fell down. We as a nation, and he's really penitent. He's part of this. And the funny thing is, he was like 15 when all this happened, and he's been there for like 60 years, right? So it'd be pretty easy to just blame everybody else and say, I can't believe, you know, all you bad kings for all these years got me stuck here. But he doesn't. He puts himself in it, and he says, man, I am sorry, God, for how we've failed you as a nation, right? We failed you. We deserve your judgment because you're righteous, right? Then he says, and because you're righteous, I know you're going to restore us, right? And it's the exact same thing that happens with Moses. He uses the same sort of plea when he's on the mountain in Sinai with God. And he says, look, these guys deserve it. I get it. But I know because you're righteous, you're going to excuse us. And I'm sort of like, I don't get it. If you're righteous, that means right. That means those people deserve punishment. I don't get the other side of this, right? So, but the way the guy explained the word in Hebrew is, a better way to think of it is, he does right by you, right? So if you're in a role as a parent, you have certain behaviors you do to do right by your kids. Sometimes that's punishing them. Sometimes that's forgiving them, right? When you're a judge, you have to do right by both parties as well, right? So if someone comes and steals your car and drives it around and crashes it into a tree, and everybody knows it's him, lots of witnesses, and you get there and the judge sort of says, well, you know, I'm feeling in a good mood today, we're just going to let you off, right? That's not justice. That's not justice to the person who owned the car, and honestly, it's not justice to the person who stole it, because there's no consequences, right? So to do right, when God is dealing with his people, is to punish them when they do wrong, right? But it's also to redeem them afterwards, right? Once you've served your punishment, once I've meted that out, it's also God being righteous to say, okay, now let's fix this. I'm going to give you the opportunity to make it right, right? So I'm going to do right by you if you do right by me, right? And that's what he says to his people all the way through the Old Testament. So, and this is a great example, this whole book, right? So, if you want to open to Daniel, we're finally there, right? chapter 1 is just him setting the stage, right? Right, I said in verse 2, it says, it talks about King Nebuchadnezzar in the first one. I'll start one even. In the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim of Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and laid siege to it. Verse 2, the Lord handed King Jehoiakim of Judah over to him, along with some of the vessels of God, and Nebuchadnezzar carried them to the land of Babylon, to the house of his God, and put the vessels in the treasury of his God. Right, so there's actually a reference elsewhere where Judah is bragging about how expensive and wonderful their vessels are in the temple. So we don't know for sure if that's why he came and took them, but it's sort of comeuppance in some ways when you do that. But either way, Babylon comes, takes all of that, and brings it back. Right, and. What he does, and it's sort of a side note, going back to doing right, I said this when I was preaching to the kids a little while ago, I was like, who do you think I get the most angry at in the whole world? Right? The only people that can really cause me to properly lose my temper completely. Right? And it's my two boys. Right? I don't lose my temper at work. I don't lose it anywhere else. Everybody knows me as like a really mellow, calm guy. Like horrible things can be happening at work, everything going crazy, and I'm just like, hey, what are you going to do? We'll just keep working, right? That's just my attitude. But man, I can absolutely lose it on Harry and Patrick, right? Because they're my boys, right? And you know how they should be behaving. You feel responsibility that they should be behaving. And you feel responsibility that you should be making them do what they're supposed to do. Right? So that is the case with God. Right? He judges the Israelites harshly because they should know better. Right? In this story, he's talking to Nebuchadnezzar. And then Nebuchadnezzar eventually says, that's it. You are God the Almighty. Right? He can't even get his own people to do it. How angering must that be as a God to say, oh, I picked you specifically. I reveal all of my secrets to you, tell you everything, give you the chance, and you're still not listening. Right? You've got to be very angering as a God. So, they are judged, right? And four young men, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, in particular are mentioned, as being taken into Babylon to be trained, right? These are very bright young men. They are taught the Babylon language. They're given new names. They are likely, it doesn't quite say it, but they're likely made eunuchs. They are put under the authority of the captain of the eunuchs, and there is no mention of their family, and it was custom at that time for the wise men typically to be eunuchs. So most likely, their opportunity to have a family was taken away from them as they were brought there. So, again, sometimes these stories are so foreign to us where we are in our world right now, right? So you're living in this city, You're going about your daily business, whatever your job is, making fishnets or being a builder or a carpenter or whatever it happens to be. An army says it wants to invade. They end up laying siege, destroying everything you know, killing huge sections of your family and friends, taking you prisoner, bringing you back to a foreign nation, saying you're now changing your name, you're learning a new language, and we're going to make you into a eunuch. Because you're now going to serve this foreign nation, right? That's like fascinatingly out of the box for us. to even imagine that that is the case. And these kids are all young. You don't know exactly, but 15, maybe 20 at the oldest. So that this is happening to them, right? So can you imagine as well the pressure to abandon God, right? So you're just like, everything that you believed in, like especially the Jews and Hebrews at that time, it was God was going to make them a great nation. And what he just did is squash their nation totally. And all of these bad things are happening to these young kids that really didn't know much better, right? All of the past failures of their nation were not really their fault, if you want to call it that, right? So there has to be a ton of pressure to just say, that's it, I'm done with this, right? I am sick of this. And the very first story shows like some significant dedication. They became vegetarians. Can you believe that? Like, that is serious. That's one of my struggles with the Bible, to be honest with you, is that in the Old Testament, pigs are unclean. And I just see them as like this miracle animal. We talk about it all the time. I was like, you could get ham and bacon and sausage from the same animal? Oh my word. And they were not allowed to eat it. That takes such willpower. It's crazy, right? Some of these young kids show up. They're like 15 or 20. And they actually say, hey, by the way, we're going to give you the king's food. We're giving you the king's steak, the king's wine. We want you guys to be healthy. You're bright. You're going to be future rulers here. We're going to train you up, right? And the way the story goes, Daniel and his friends say, we're not really supposed to eat that. Is it okay if we eat vegetarian instead? That is crazy. Like, you know what I mean? We talk about it like it's small, but it's not. You're in a foreign nation. Everything's taken away from you. And people are saying, hey, by the way, and everyone else is doing it. Clearly, they weren't the only Hebrews there. And these four of them go to their boss and say, hey, by the way, can we instead eat vegetarian for a while? And they peacefully work out a solution where they can not break the rules of Jewish custom. So we're going to spend next week. So sorry to break the news to you. I am here again next week. And we'll be discussing Daniel again. So next week we will talk about being in exile. This was just sort of the very first little story about it. And I will mention sort of a quick little piece. But you can see how they are, to a certain extent, they're being good citizens. They're taking new names, they're wearing the clothes, they're learning the language, they're doing a lot of that stuff, right? But they clearly locate their identity in Christ. And not as a Babylonian, not even necessarily as a Hebrew. They locate their identity in God, in their case, right? And then they, in their case, actually peacefully, and in some cases super polite. It's kind of funny with the Shadrach, Meshach story. They're actually really polite. They're just sort of like, well, excuse me, sir, but I can't happen to follow your evil edicts. I'm very sorry about that. And that's sort of the method that they use, right? So, and chapter 1 finishes by saying, God bless them, they're wiser than all the others, everything is going right. And there's a little comment that sort of says, Daniel ruled in, was in this nation until such and such a time. What you don't quite realize is that 65 years he spends in Babylon. So that's an awful long time, right? Crazy. So, we could continue, obviously, the way 95% of people do with chapter 2 and keep going on through the study. We could look at those little bookend things that I said, and we could do chapter 2 and chapter 7, and then chapter 3 and chapter 6. But I'm strange, and I think the way it sort of sets up, if you start with chapters 4 and 5, the meat of the story in the middle, and then work out, it seems to fit better in my brain in the way it works, right? Because 4 and 5, basically, is like I said, you're behind that curtain of God dealing with the rulers of these nations. Then you see, if you go to the bookends of those, you see how people live under these kings, their interactions with them, how God protects them, how they do these things. And then you go to the bookends of that, and it's how God judges these nations as a whole, and how he's going to judge all nations into the future. Right? So I sort of like the way it steps out that way, then starting with God judges all nations now and into the future, then you're stepping into sort of how to live in these nations, and then you get to, so it seems backwards to me, right? So you're stuck with it because I'm up here. So we are going to start in chapter 4 is where the main meat of this sermon is going to be, actually. Right? So let me get there. There we go. All right. So, one of the things you sort of noticed as this happens, and I'm going to point this out at the end, for those of you that are like messages that have all sort of very personal takeaways of how you can apply this to your life. One, I think understanding how God looks at nations and judges nations and kings and rulers, I think is important. It is sort of a personal takeaway, even though it's not a personal takeaway, if that makes sense. And I do have a few of those at the end of the message saying, hey, by the way, did you notice these threads in the story that are sort of more personal takeaways? But one of those is, in these stories, these kings, these rulers, they're battling with sin and issues in their life, right? And God is dealing with them personally, just like he's dealing with you, right? So if you talk to another Christian, you're going to tell them stories about what happens in your life. You know, sometimes God does miracles and just lines everything up for you, and sometimes you're in a dry spell, as Matt mentioned. You just, you know, you go through these personal stories and you tell them. And then we have these leaders of nations, and we don't really think of them as people, being honest, right? We don't think of them having to deal with these same stories, right? So, you know, we have rulers, our president, who has a son who can be quite wayward, right? And we want to just look at it as the news story, and I can't believe this, and I can't believe that, whatever. But all of us have wayward family members, whether they be sons or brothers or whoever it is, or your brother's son or something. These people that are in your family that are just broken. And it kills families, doesn't it? It causes you such heartache and such angst, right? So we as people need to understand, we need to pray for our leaders. A lot, right? They are going through the same types of trials and tribulations that we are. And wouldn't it be amazing if they just had a come to God moment and said, hey, from now on, I'm going to rule the way God would want me to rule. Right? Wouldn't that be awesome? So keep that in mind. And we will start, finally, Jared, 4:1. 4:1-3. And it is, starts out, King Nebuchadnezzar, right? So basically, he's writing this. To those of every people, nation, and language who live on the whole earth, may your prosperity increase. I'm pleased to tell you about the miracles and wonders the Most High God has done for me. And he's speaking about the actual God, not some Moloch fruity thing, whatever, right? So this is Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, starting out, which is a formal proclamation from the Babylonian government with a letter saying, hey, by the way, let me tell you about this God I have. Like Vicky always says, right? Let me tell you about this God, right? And you're like, is this some sort of bizarro world? How did we end up with this situation, right? As we go through the story, you'll find out at the end, he disappears for a while before coming back. So this is likely a letter saying, hey, by the way, about that couple of years I was gone, this is what was happening while I was gone. And it is a formal letter written to his people, right? Laying all of this out. So, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and flourishing in my palace when I had a dream. Right? So, which is pretty common. So I'm not going to read every line all the way through the whole thing, but he tells you, surprisingly enough, about the dream. He goes and gets Daniel, earlier in the story, Daniel interprets the dream for him, so he's sort of like, all right, I got Daniel on speed dial. He brings him out, and he says, here is my dream, right? In my vision, I was lying in my bed. It's verse 10, and it says, there was a tree in the middle of the earth. It was very tall. The tree grew large and strong, and its top reached to the sky. Right, this whole section has a whole ton of Eden imagery, right? And basically, it's sort of laying out that for the most part, his nation was actually somewhat orderly and working, right? It was functioning in the way things were supposed to function. Its leaves were beautiful, its fruit was abundant, and on it was food for all. Wild animals found shelter under it, the birds of the sky lived in its branches, and every creature was fed from it. Right? So it sort of lays out this quick image of things were actually kind of working the way they're supposed to, right? It was kind of going okay. As I was laying in my bed, I also saw visions of my mind, a watcher, a holy one coming down from heaven. This is where it goes downhill for him, right? He called out loudly, cut down the tree and chop off its branches. Strip off its leaves, scatter its fruit, let the animals flee from under it and the birds from its branches, but leave the stump with its roots in the ground, right? That represents the fact that there can be redemption in this story, right? They didn't uproot the tree. They actually protect it. The next line is with a band of iron and bronze around it. So what it's saying is, this is going to be cut down, but that isn't necessarily the end of the story. There's a stump left, right? And then it says, in the tender grass of the field, and all of a sudden it switches tenses and says, let him be drenched with dew from the sky, right? That's the stump that he's talking about. But clearly in your vision, this isn't about a stump, right? So this is about Nebuchadnezzar. So let him be drenched with dew from the sky and share the plants of the earth with the animals. Let his mind be changed from that of a human, and let him be given the mind of an animal. Right? So going back to that image of God, right? We were here to rule on behalf of God over those beasts. Right? Instead, we exalt ourselves. That's the story. Right? So now Nebuchadnezzar is exalting himself, and God is saying, well, if that's what you want to do, then you're going to end up being lowered down and end up being a beast in the field, right? If you're not going to submit to my authority, rule on my behalf the way things are supposed to be, then this is what's going to happen, right? So this idea that, you know, we're made in God's image. We are the only people that can really live for others, right? It's not like a herd instinct. It's not something that we're just trying to better our genetic pool or whatever. You know, it's not some sort of instinct. We can actually just plain love other people and act on that, right? And that's so unique to be human. So, if you don't know, if you're new here, I teach science at the college. And sometimes people will make comments, well, you know, we got 98% of the same genes as a monkey. We're almost the same. They can even use tools. And you're sort of like, what are you talking about? You know? That you can love your neighbor, that you can create these communities, that Mozart can make a symphony is not the same as a monkey bashing something on a rock. Right? And those are two worlds apart. It's just not even close, right? Loving your neighbor is a uniquely human thing, or we should say a uniquely godly thing, because we're made in his image, right? So he gave that to us. Right? And we can also resist the instincts and urges that we have, right? So we are given something wonderful in marriage by God, and we can take advantage of that. We can push it too far, and we can give in to beastly impulses, or flesh, as the way it calls it in the New Testament, and get into lust and other things. With food, we can enjoy our food. We can be gluttonous. With our private property, God says we should flourish. We should have private property. But you can be greedy. You can steal. Right? So all of these things are there, and he expects us to sort of put bounds on that. And the awesome thing in the New Testament, going back to Steve's message, just last week, I think it was, right? That the Holy Spirit can lead you to all truth. It can actually aid you in that, right? If you want to, and we're going to get into that story a little bit more, but if you want to resist those urges, that sin, that fleshly nature, you've got a helper that can help you get there, right? So, verse 25 is Daniel sort of interpreting all this to Nebuchadnezzar, and he says, until you acknowledge the Most High as ruler over human kingdoms, and he gives them, you're going to be turned into a beast until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over human kingdoms, and he gives them to anyone he wants. All right? So, what happens is, basically God gives him sort of a year. And that's what Daniel says. He's like, you're given a little bit of time to change your ways because you're not acknowledging God. And he gives him a year. Nebuchadnezzar, at the end of the year, and it almost makes it seem like to the day, basically, at the end of the year, he is on his royal palace where he started, flourishing and wonderful, right? And he says in verse 30, is this not Babylon the Great that I have built to be a royal residence by my vast power and for my majestic glory? Right? I think this is where the saying famous last words comes in. So immediately a voice from heaven comes down to him and says, basically, you are going to now be a beast in the field. Right? Some people think it's, there's actually, if you can believe this, there is a psychological mental condition called boanthropy, where you think you are a cow. And it can cause medical issues because you continue to eat grass, which is not super healthy for you in large quantities. So whether it was that, whether it was just a God-inspired thing, one way or the other, he ends up going out in the field. And it says for seven periods of time. Most people think that's 7 years. But it clearly is some length of time that this happens, right? That he ends up out with wild donkeys thinking he is some sort of beast in the field. So, you assume that's the end of the story, right? But it can't be the end of the story because this is a first-hand account from Nebuchadnezzar saying, hey, by the way, at the beginning, God is the Most High, he's in charge, right? So at the end of those seven periods of time, 34, I, Nebuchadnezzar, looked up to heaven and my sanity returned to me. Then I praised the Most High and honored and glorified him who lives forever. Right? And he's got a nice little poem there. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are counted as nothing, and he does what he wants with the army of heaven and the inhabitants of earth. Right? And Nebuchadnezzar is actually reestablished as leader, right? So he's actually restored to his previous role as king, and rules for a number of other years. Most people estimate somewhere in the region of 10. They're not really sure. If it's a full 7 years that he was out in the field, then it'll probably be a little bit less than 10. They don't have the exact numbers and how all these things work out. But he ruled for quite a while after that, right? So, if you sort of think through that story that I started with, right? In the garden, man exalted himself, didn't listen to God on a personal level because they wanted to be like God, and it didn't go well, and they get consequences, right? Then they all get together as Babylon, and they exalt themselves again, and they don't listen to God's authority, and it doesn't go well, right? So in this story right here, you're getting just sort of a peek of all of that, right? That he doesn't acknowledge it at first, and it doesn't go well. But he repents, right? And he says, fair enough, you are the God Most High. Babylon was quite an impressive place at that time. I don't know if you knew that. So it was incredibly well known for like the walls around the city, which is going to come up in the next story. And it had rivers through it. One of the wonders of the world was Nebuchadnezzar actually made the Hanging Gardens for one of his wives. And it was considered one of the seven wonders of the world at that time. It was a massive indoor garden with irrigation and all kinds of stuff right? So it was pretty impressive. So they ruled a good chunk of the known world. So for the king of that to say, I'm bowing a knee to the real Most High God, is pretty impressive, right? Especially at that time. So flip that around, and we'll go quick through this one. Belshazzar is the next story, right? So what happens in between that you don't find out is after Nebuchadnezzar dies, you get sort of a 10 or 15 year span where a couple of people come in quick and get assassinated, and doesn't go too well. And then eventually Belshazzar's father takes over, and Belshazzar becomes a co-regent. So the two of them are ruling together. So it doesn't actually mention his father so much, because his father, believe it or not, was out of town. He was fighting the Medes. He was leading an army outside of the city in a fight, in a war. His son was in charge inside. Going back to those stories of wayward family members who maybe make some bad choices in life. He decides to have a party with an army outside of the city, because he assumes no one is going to get through the walls of Babylon. They were known for having like several years worth of stores inside. So even if they were sieged, they had water supplies, they had rivers going under the city, they had food. So why not throw a party, right? For thousands of people. And in that time, in general, women weren't usually at the party. And actually, they didn't usually drink, because you were meant to be this larger-than-life king, right? So if you get drunk and misbehave and act silly, then it sort of undermines your authority as king. So typically, if you have big parties where you invite thousands of people, it's just the men, and you don't have drinking there, right? So Belshazzar decides to break both of those rules and have a wild, raging party with an army outside of his place. Things get really excitable. So he decides to ask for the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple in Israel, the house of God in Jerusalem. So the king and the nobles and the wives and concubines drank from them. They drank the wine and praised their gods made of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Right? So this is pretty much the peak of debauchery, right? This is like as bad as you can get in the story. And surprisingly enough, a giant hand appears and writes a message on the wall. So if you know it from nowhere else, you might know the Johnny Cash song that explains the story, right, of the writing on the wall for Belshazzar. And if you are reading this, a slightly confusing note off the topic, Daniel's new name when he's in Babylon is Belteshazzar, and the king's name is Belshazzar. Gets a little confusing as you're reading it. I refer to him as Daniel all the time, but sometimes it says Belteshazzar, and so you're sort of like two letters in the middle difference, and they're two key people, and it can sort of throw you off as you're reading the story. Anyway, this hand appears. Some of the famous sayings we have in the English language, his knees knocked together. The king's knees was the first time they said that. When he saw the writing on the wall. So some of these famous sayings that we have that are all from the Bible, actually. So they believe that that was the first time the expression knees knocked together. Which you can imagine if you're having a crazy party and everything's going and then a giant dismembered hand starts writing on your wall. you could probably see why. There's another one that says basically like his hips became loose, and they're not sure if that meant he actually soiled himself, or it's sort of an odd expression that gets interpreted in many different ways. But clearly he was a little bit scared that this happened. So his mother, basically the queen mother, comes in and says, hey, by the way, Daniel is the man. We've got him on speed dial. He tells you all of these things, right? So they bring Daniel in again to look at this, right? And he says, hey, by the way, Daniel, if you could tell me what this is, you'll be great. You'll have money. You'll have whatever. And Daniel's like, trust me. I've been here like 60 years at this point. Money and fame are not anything to me. You can keep all that. But I will tell you what is going on, right? And what he goes about saying is, hey, by the way, either you were there and witnessed firsthand, or you read the letter in chapter 4, about Nebuchadnezzar being humbled by the mighty God. You know that story. You saw it happen. The man was literally out eating grass in the fields because he would not acknowledge God. And you are doing the same thing. You're not learning from any of this. You are not ruling in a way that is fit for a king, right? So, instead, you've exalted yourself against the Lord of heavens, is the way he said it. So, you have not glorified the God who holds your life breath in his hand and who controls the whole course of your life. Therefore, he sent this hand to give these words, right? So we won't spend too much time on the words. They are neat, and you can sort of talk about them. But give or take, he says, Johnny Cash, you've been weighed in the balance and found wanting, right? So you've been weighed up by God, and you seriously, seriously failed that test, right? And hence, there's going to be some judgment coming about on you, right? And in this case, there's no waiting period. That judgment happens that night, right? It's actually a famous historical story. What the Medes do is they divert the river in the middle of the night. That is their source of water. One of the reasons they thought they were indestructible, they diverted the river, and as the river went down, they went in underneath the city and came up inside and took it from inside. So he was killed that night. So that very night, Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, was killed. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62, right? So that is actually the end of an entire nation, a large, powerful nation, right? That story. Because at that point, the Persians and Medes take over, and they are the next in the line of these nations that come up, right? So this is the heart. You're sort of looking behind the curtain and seeing, okay, one king, despite clearly all of his flaws, you miss. He's actually had several of these situations where he's actually admitted God as ruler because of all these things happening. So Daniel tells him a vision, and he says, "You're right, Daniel. That's amazing. You must have the one true God." And then the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego get thrown in the furnace, and they come out with this holy person. And he's like, "Oh wow, we should all worship your God. Yeah, it's great." And then you get to this story, and he's still forgotten it, right? But he does repent when it's brought to his attention over and over and over again, right? Whereas the second king, clearly too far gone, and the whole nation is judged, right? So this is sort of the heart of Babylon, men exalting themselves and eventually sort of behaving like beasts because they're not acting in the way God wants them to. He's not ruling on their behalf. They're not seeking justice. They're not seeking righteousness. They're not acknowledging God's authority, right? So, we know that Babylon is truly defeated. Babylon is the archetype about 500 years later when Jesus is on the cross, right? And we'll go over that next week. And we'll talk about some of that story and how it relates into Jesus as well, which is kind of cool. So, but a couple of sort of personal takeaways for me or thoughts on this as we're sort of looking at it is, first off, admire Daniel, right? At that point, he's in his 80s, got no interest, fame and fortune. He's been there his entire life, an exile, right? And it's just amazing that you can be in that sort of situation. My pages went all flying all over the place. There you go. He continued to remain faithful while sitting in the literal heart of Babylon. Everything taken away from him. For 80 straight years, he had hope, right? Because he knew that our God is the real God. Humbly ask, and this is me too, trust me, I am there with you, that you pray for our rulers. Yes. There are spiritual battles going on with all of us at a personal level that impacts nations, right? And we need to be praying and have a broken heart for some of those people because they are deceived and lost in a big time way, right? And we're not going to solve that. So getting angry at them from our seats at home isn't going to fix that. Praying to the Almighty God might. And that is not me sort of saying, hey, by the way, you guys should be like me, trust me. So my wife gets that all the time. I'm like, can you believe they actually said this out loud? So, we all do those things, but we should, in between at least, be broken by these things, right? We should understand of the pain and all of that that's going on behind and inside these people. So another takeaway is, like, we're all going to come face to face with God sometimes, right? Nebuchadnezzar was literally the king of the world, right? He ruled the largest nation in the entire world. There was no, like, democracy, whatever. He was in charge. What he said goes. And in a span of moments, he was living with donkeys in the field, eating grass, right? You can't have a fall any bigger than what he had, right? So it's not to make light of your trials, but if you're looking at the things that you're going through, right? If you've had a fall, if you've lost a job, you've got problems in your marriage, you've got, you know, death and family hardships going on, those are all real things, right? By all means. But at the same time, God restored Nebuchadnezzar when he exalted God and said, God, you are in charge, right? Sort of parallels the Job story. We have a kid's version of Job. We did, I don't know where it went, but we had a kid's version. And you can actually sort of start to laugh because all the messengers arrive and it sort of talks through the messengers. And they're arriving like, oh yeah, this collapsed and it killed all your animals. Oh yeah, here's another message, this happens. And yeah, your whole family's dead. And you're like, ah. And you can almost chuckle at it. And you're like, actually, that's pretty dark. You're like, that's not good at all. Right? He lost everything, literally everything, down to just rolling in the dirt. Right? And it was challenging. And I would assume it was not fun for Job to go through that. But he restored him at the end of it. Right? He didn't restore everything back. It's not going to be the same family. It's not going to be the same thing he had. Right? But he did restore him in God. So, where are you placing your hope? This is a real big picture sort of chapter, big picture book, to be honest with you. Right? So, are you placing all of your hope in yourself, your abilities, in your control? I can control this. Or are you exalting yourself instead of letting God be in charge? Right? Are you placing your hope in your family? I could probably be guilty of that. Put a lot of focus on my family. I love my family, but I have to love God more. Right? So all of that can disappear. All of us have lost loved ones. In your country, you can have hope for your country without placing hope in your country. Right? And we need to keep that clear in all of our hearts. You know, pray for our country, hope for our country, but your hope should be in something stronger than that. Or you're going to be building on sand. Right? So, Daniel had none of these things. He was a slave. He didn't really have personal control. Didn't have a family. His nation was destroyed. And yet, all the way through the book, he has endless hope. Right? Just fascinating to read that. So, our God is a God of order. He sits on the throne. He's sovereign and he's righteous. That means he's in charge. And he will do right by us. Whether it's in this life or the next, he is going to make sure to make all things right with each one of us individually, right? And his nations. So, thank you, Father God, for allowing us to dig into your word. Please help it to order our thinking, to give us structure in our days and also peace in our days, knowing that ultimately you are in control. Help us to exalt you in all that we do. And just please stay faithful to your promises to be our God if we will be your people. In Jesus' name, amen.